Yeah, right.
I'll call the tax committee to order. Good morning, good afternoon. Welcome, Ms. Dalton. Welcome. Where are we?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we were just going to start talking about sales tax rates.
Yes,
so
please.
So I will start with that. As everyone knows, the general sales tax rate, including the legacy tax, is 6.875%. However, we do have some special rates in law as well. Short-term rental motor vehicles, and those are vehicle rentals like you would do at the airport, 28 days or less, are subject to an extra 6.5% tax, so their tax rate is 13.075. In addition, motor vehicle rental tax is subject to a 5% fee, bringing that total really up to 18.075%. The state does not get that second 5% generally. That money actually, although it's stated as a state-imposed fee, it's actually used to reimburse the car rental companies for their motor vehicle registration tax. And the state only sees money if they collect more than what they've actually paid in their registration tax. Manufactured housing and park trailers. They pay the regular rate, but they only pay it on 65% of the sales price. And that's to make them somewhat comparable to new housing. New housing, we don't impose a sales tax on housing generally, but sales tax is paid on construction materials used in constructing new housing, and that's assumed to be about 65% of the cost of any new housing. So this makes them comparable. And then finally, as we said, because the motor vehicle sales tax in Chapter 297B is not subject to the legacy tax, that tax is only 6.5%.
23 on ours. 45.
Sales tax base.
That's what?
The way we think about, most people when they think about sales tax, it is supposed to be a tax on final consumption. However, that's not quite how it works. Generally, the way to think of the sales tax base in this state is goods are usually taxable unless there is a specific exemption in the statute. Services and other intangibles, such as digital downloads, are not taxable unless specifically included in the tax base. I should have stayed back on the slide. There's a number of services that are currently taxable because they are listed. Some of them have been taxable for a long time, such as lodging and cable and I can't remember the other television service, satellite dish. Yeah, okay, I can't. I was blanking. A number of services became taxable in 1987. You'll often hear people refer to the 1987 services. Those include things like tanning and health clubs and car washes and security services and pet boarding and dry cleaning and laundry and a lot of those little services. As I said, intangibles, we tax our cable and direct satellite. We also tax downloaded canned computer software, pre-written computer software. And telecommunication services. A lot of the intangibles we don't tax really didn't even exist at the time that the sales tax was imposed. I mean, there were no such thing as e-cards and e-books and video streaming video on demand and things like that. So that would actually require us going in and modifying the tax base. The major exemptions for individuals that are actually listed in the statutes tend to include the big two are food for home consumption and clothing. Other ones are home heating fuels, motor fuels. We don't pay sales tax when you buy gas for your car. However, you are paying the gas tax instead. All drugs for human consumption are not subject to tax, although some of those drugs are subject to the MnCare, the healthcare provider tax. Newspapers and subscription magazines are not taxed, and cigarettes are also exempt, but they are subject to an in-lieu tax instead, and Mr. Bickerstaff will actually talk about that when he gets to the alcohol and tobacco taxes later. Things that are not explicitly taxed and therefore are exempt for individuals include a lot of personal services, haircuts, tattoos, pedicures and manicures, repair services, and professional services, accounting, lawyers, things like that. As I said, most of us think of sales tax as a tax on consumption. But as we said earlier, about 44% of the tax is actually paid by businesses on their inputs. There's been a move throughout the history of the 80s and 90s to actually provide more exemptions for business inputs. The big ones are capital equipment, farm machinery, direct inputs to agricultural and industrial production, and now some of the direct inputs to those 1987 services. But we continue to tax a lot of business purchases. One of the big ones is office furniture, fixtures, and supplies. You know, you buy papers, pencils, everything for your business, you're going to change those. Equipment used in providing taxable services, all of that is taxable. And inputs to non-manufacturing industries generally are taxable, the big ones being restaurant and lodging. They do not get exemptions on any of their inputs. In addition to exemptions by type of item being sold, we also have exemptions for types of entities either making the sale or making the purchase. We talked yesterday about the fact that the state pays sales tax and most local governments pay sales tax. However, we do not tax sales to schools, we do not tax sales to federal government, we do not tax sales to public libraries or to hospitals. There are other selected sales by local governments that are not taxed. Probably the biggest one is public safety equipment for fire and police. We do not tax sales to certain nonprofit charitable organizations. Basically, we do not tax sales to to nonprofits that are engaged in charitable, religious, and educational functions. We also do not tax sales to certain nonprofits that serve kids and seniors and veterans groups. We also don't tax sales by certain nonprofits. Again, we have some fundraising exemptions. We have a limited fundraising exemption for the first $10,000 per organization of fundraising by organizations that primarily serve kids and senior citizens. And then we have some other selected fundraising exemptions, but those have to meet some very, very specific requirements. And then one other is nonprofit arts organizations. There's no sales tax imposed on their admissions. And at that, I'm going to actually turn this over to to Mr. Bickerstaff, who is going to actually start doing Streamline.
Welcome, Mr. Bickerstaff.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Again, for the record, I'm Andrew Bickerstaff. I'm the newest member of the Tax Human Health Research. As Ms. Dalton said, I'll be covering Streamline from this point on. First of all, the issue of internet or remote sales tax, there's a constitutional limit on a state's ability to tax sellers that don't have a physical presence or what's known as a nexus with the state. The U.S. Constitution gives Congress the power to regulate interstate taxes, which is where that prohibition comes from. Therefore, Congress does have the ability to pass legislation which would allow states to collect those taxes. As some of you may be familiar, there were three separate bills introduced in Congress last year that all made it to varying stages of the legislative process. None of them was enacted into law, and until Congress does so, that issue will remain on the state level. And as the slide indicates, it was estimated that $204 million in revenue or tax revenue was not collected in 2011 from internet sales in Minnesota. it's sort of the flip side to the state's inability to mandate or require sellers to tax internet purchases. There's what's known as the Streamlined Sales and Use Tax Agreement, which is a voluntary agreement between states and remote sellers. Currently, there are 20 full member states. Excuse me. A full member state is a state that's passed legislation conforming to the Streamline Agreement. There are two associate member states. An associate member state is defined as a state that's passed legislation that's not yet in effect, but will come into effect, that conforms to the Streamline Agreement. Again, as the slide points out, in the first 7 years that Minnesota's been a full member of Streamline, $149.3 million has been voluntarily remitted to the state from internet sellers. And then one other issue you may be familiar with, late last fall, Minnesota was found to be out of compliance with the Streamlined Agreement based on our definition of prepared food. In December, there was a vote by the governing board and the other full member states, and the vote found that while Minnesota was out of compliance with the agreement, we were not substantially out of compliance with the agreement. So at this point, it doesn't appear that sanctions will be handed down. One additional note on that, the president of the governing board has called for a discussion about what the term substantial compliance means, so it may be an issue that needs to be revisited depending on what the board decides to define that term as.
Excuse me, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have two questions. One is going back to the estimated revenue of $204 million in 2011 in the internet sales. Does that assume that Amazon pulls out of the state, or what are the assumptions on the $204 million?
Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I believe that estimate is assuming that nobody pulls out of the state. That is, you know, so this isn't really dealing with that affiliate nexus bill and what would happen if the affiliate nexus bill had been passed. This is just what we think we are not collecting on currently taxable sales because they are coming over the internet or through another remote like catalogs, and therefore we don't have nexus with the seller.
Okay, great.
Representative Anderson.
I'll leave it. That's good.
I think, Representative Anderson, maybe I'm wrong, but I think maybe the way that's reading is it implies that, I guess you could kind of read it that it's the losses if we did affiliate nexus. I think what it's saying is because we don't have affiliate nexus, we lose $204 million a year. Is that what it's trying to say?
Madam Chair, I would say actually this is if Congress enacted one of the Main Street Fairness Acts, okay, this is how much money we would have seen in 2011 if there had been a duty to collect.
And I think, if I may, for Representative David's heard this, the affiliate nexus bill in the past too, and I think that revenue estimate was around $4 million a year. It's not a big, at least initially, doesn't bring in a lot of money to the state. It's more, you know, it's a subjective term, but people would say it's about fairness, not about revenue. But I think others would say it's about compliance, and it's not about revenue at all. And maybe Ms. Dalton, because we know the governor's proposed that the last couple of years, and my guess is he will again. Can you tell the committee, in case we all hear that on Tuesday, if it's in there, what the, you know, is it a tax or is it compliance to a law that people aren't complying with? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I may actually end up deferring a little bit to Mr. Michael on this because we actually have affiliate rules in this state already. If you have an affiliate in this state, that provides nexus in this state, and therefore you have to collect the tax. What the affiliate nexus bill is either, you know, and some people would say it's an expansion of the affiliate or the existing affiliate nexus, or it's a clarification. But basically it's saying that if you are a remote seller, if you're an internet seller, and you are essentially using what are called click-through entities that are located in this state. If somebody goes to a website located in this state and you're on their website and they can click through and make a purchase, and you are then going to compensate that website for those purchases made by them clicking through your website, those people are nexus for you, and that therefore you should be collecting this state. They're basically it's saying those are agents. just the way if you had somebody physically here in the state, that would be an agent. They're saying if you have a website that you're using that's located in the state, that's an agent as well.
So I guess the parallel I was trying to get to is that's why some legislators bipartisanly will say it's not a tax, it's compliance, because we already have a law that says you're supposed to be paying that. And maybe just one other thing for new committee members, if you can explain how individuals are supposed to be collecting their own tax and remitting it in the use tax and help members understand, you know, we know almost no one does that, but the de minimis and kind of how these are linked.
Well, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative David.
I think I can clear this up very quickly. I support those provisions of the governor, and so it is a compliance issue.
Perfect.
Just want to clear that up.
Bipartisan on this committee, I guess. No. Thank you, Representative Davids.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, actually, we keep talking about the sales tax. We should really technically talk about the sales and use tax. Like most states with the sales tax, Minnesota has a complementary use tax. If you purchase something that is subject to sales tax in this state and you did not pay the sales tax and you're going to use it in this state, you owe the tax as a use tax. We do collect this from businesses quite a bit. Businesses make purchases from out of state. They pay the use tax. We tend to find out about them if they don't when we audit them. However, we don't tend to audit individuals on their sales tax payments very much. So even though individuals owe use tax as well, it's rarely paid. Back in the, 1996, roughly thereabouts, the legislature actually passed a law saying, we don't want to make everybody who's not paying use tax a criminal. So what they did is they provided a de minimis exemption for personal use tax payments. If you owe less than... I believe it was if you purchased less than about $770 a year that you haven't paid sales tax on, you don't have to file and pay use tax.
Can you give us some examples? Like if you bought $770 worth of taxable items at garage sales, or if you, give us some examples of how people buy things and don't pay the tax they're supposed to and don't realize they're supposed to.
Well, and Madam Chair, actually garage sales is a very bad example because there is actually an exemption for isolated and occasional sales, which is often referred to as the garage, the yard sale or the garage.
How about if I go to some other state that doesn't collect a sales tax and I buy something there and then I drive it home? Am I not supposed to report that to you or to the Department of Revenue?
Madam Chair, representatives, technically, yes. And if you paid sales tax in the other state, you get a credit for what you paid in the other state. But if the tax in the other state is lower, yes, you do actually technically owe the difference of the tax as use tax in this state. If you purchase something over the internet and it is normally subject to sales tax, in this state, you technically owe use tax on that. You buy clothing from landsend.com, you're fine because we don't tax clothing. You purchase something from Dell, you purchase a computer from Dell, technically you owe use tax. Actually, I believe Dell is now collecting our tax, but yes, if you purchase, you know, electronics and all those big ticket items that are normally subject to tax, those are things that you do owe use tax. And if you're purchasing something worth more than $770, clearly you owe use tax on it. If your total taxes over a calendar year that fall into that category are $770 or less, then you wouldn't owe the use tax. You have that de minimis exemption.
I want to go back to Representative Anderson and Draskowski. So if I buy a car online, and lots of people do that, that's clearly a big purchase price. Can I avoid the tax somehow on that?
Madam Chair, actually, that's one you can't avoid the tax on. Because there are a few really large ticket items that have to be registered in the state. And so we have often piggybacked sales tax administration on registration. When you purchase a car, if you go to register the car in the state, license it in the state, they're going to ask for proof of sales tax purchase, of sales tax paid. And if you haven't paid it, you'll pay it at that time. If you paid it in the other state, you will pay the difference at that time. Same is true for boats, trailers, snowmobiles, SUVs, things like that. Anything that basically requires licensing in this state, we tend to piggyback the sales tax administration on top of that.
I just recall when I was in the minority, I was on a tax conference committee, and there was a Republican senator, and I think his name was Curring or something like that, and he bought a lot of art, and he used to raise this issue that he was the only guy in the state who paid use tax because he was honest. And I can't remember if that was his name. Do you remember that? He was a Republican senator, and he came and he purchased, you know, expensive art. And because he bought it other places, he could have avoided a lot of tax, but he honestly paid it. So,
and in places where that's a really big issue, there are a lot of states who actually do go after that. That's really been an issue in New York City. And, you know, they ship things out to New Jersey and then actually physically carry them back into New York to avoid having paid the tax. And there's a lot of audit that goes on in New York City because of that, on artwork.
Representative Davids, do you remember his name?
Well,
Mr. Michaels thinks it's Winona.
Yeah,
Senator Carolyn.
Yeah.
Okay.
He was one that bought all the art. In fact, he built a beautiful museum in Winona to display.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Yep.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not to belabor this point, but at some point, if you could give me a little better details on that $204 million, I'd be curious if they assume that...
That's somebody's cell phone, for folks who may not know. If your cell phone's too close to the system, it'll do that.
I'm assuming that they're not including that de minimis $770 in the calculation for the $204 million. But offline, we could talk more about it, so I don't want to take up more time.
Thank you. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious if someone is avoiding this as a tax avoidance or is it evasion?
No. Madam Chair, without knowing the actual legal definition of either, I would defer to Mr. Michael, but my gut reaction would be this would be evasion, not avoidance.
We'll ask the attorney just to share. Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, I think the terms you're using are sort of what the common sort of understanding of those words are. Avoidance, to me, usually means that you have successfully legally not paid the tax because the law allows you to not do that, whereas evasion means you're doing it illegally. So based on my understanding of those words, this would probably be evasion because you do owe the tax. Everybody knows that you're not going to, it's very unlikely that you will be audited to collect it, and so you're essentially saying, I'm not going to pay it because I don't think they'll catch me, but you legally owe it. Whereas if you, you know, retain a corporate lawyer who sets up a reorganization that allows you to, you know, avoid recognizing tax, that's avoidance, but not evasion.
Representative Drazkowski.
Well, I would just like to thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Michael, and Ms. Dalton, and I'm just glad to see that there are people in Minnesota that are avoiding 200 and some million dollars of their money that they can spend on their own being sent to the government for waste, fraud, and abuse.
Thank you. Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, the one other thing I would actually point out is in our state income tax instructions, if you actually get the printed book, there is a big half-page explanation of the need to file use tax. There have been a number of bills offered in the past to actually add a use tax line to the income tax statement. A number of other states do this. However, they have not passed in this state. Primarily, the Department of Revenue doesn't want it done because it will kick the one-page, it will kick us past the one-page limit on the tax form.
Other questions? If not, Mr. Biggerstaff, please, or wherever we were.
Oh.
Madam Chair, actually, I think that's all we're going to say about streamlined and remote sales, but we're going to talk about the sales tax reform options, similar to what Ms. Manzi did for the income tax. Essentially, as she said, there were four things to look at: adequacy, administrative costs, efficiency, and equity. I do want to talk about adequacy. The economy in Minnesota and nationally has changed since the sales tax was first instituted in 1967. At one time, we were primarily a goods economy. We are now much more of a service economy. Much greater percentage of final consumption is through services, and we are now entering a new age, and that is the information age. And we are seeing a phenomenal growth, not just in sales over the internet and the Nexus issue, but we are seeing things that traditionally were taxable goods now become information streams. It's the e-books, it's the downloaded or streamed video and music. These things are not part of our sales tax base right now. So even as our economy is growing, our sales tax base is shrinking, and so the sales tax revenues are not going to keep up with the growth in the economy over the long term. So in terms of that adequacy, that's something you need to keep in mind. They have several times. As I've said several times, sales tax should be thought of as a consumption tax. So most economists would say that if you want to reform sales tax, you want to make it closer to a tax on as much consumption, final consumption by personal consumers as possible, and you do not want to expand the tax to business purchases. So there is a, I believe, in your, in the large packet on page 31, there is a list of items that are constant, that are commonly looked at when we're looking at expanding the consumer, the sales tax base, and how much money each of those would raise. And I'm not going to go through that detailed list, but there's fairly significant amounts of revenue in that group. If you expand the base, good tax policy says a low a broad base and a low rate is better than a narrow base and a high rate. We have one of the higher rates in the state in the country. There's only six other states with sales taxes higher than ours. State sales tax is higher than ours, although a lot of them have local sales taxes. So by expanding the base, you could clearly reduce the rate. You could exempt more business inputs and make the tax more closely a truly a final consumption tax. One of the issues that you run into when you look at sales expanding the sales tax base is that sales tax is a regressive tax, and so it tends to fall more heavily on people in the lowest decile. Mm-hmm. If that is a concern and you want to reduce regressivity, you could certainly take some of the additional revenues from an expanded base and use it for a targeted low-income credit, which is something that other states do as well. Issues that you need to think about when you're looking at base expansion is the Nexus issue. We absent federal legislation or additional court action, there is not much we can do about internet sales tax except kind of the affiliate nexus bill. But the other thing to take a look at is administrative difficulties in looking at what you are taxing. There are issues that some things are purchased both by businesses and consumers. Car repair is an example, accounting services, legal services, things that are mainly purchased by businesses and are not normally purchased by individuals, you might want to think about not including in a base broadening, mainly just because every time you draw a line, you end up with more administrative costs. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you want to basically focus on taxing things that are primarily consumer expenditures. The other thing that gets that can be problematic are issues of things that are particularly used by both small businesses and personal. We talked about that a little bit yesterday when we were talking about when a sole proprietor has a will drawn up. Is that a business expense or is that a personal expense? Should it be taxable or shouldn't it be taxable? And finally, the other thing to look at is there are some services that you could think about taxing, but those services are very footloose. And so they could avoid nexus in this state if we impose the tax on them by essentially moving out of the state. This was a problem. Florida actually several years ago looked at really broadening their sales tax base and didn't always do it just to consumer, but they did it to things like advertising and legal services. And essentially people were just saying, fine, we're just going to go purchase it from somebody outside the state. And so that became an issue. So those are kind of the issues that you need to think about when you're looking at sales tax reform. We're going to do a hopefully very short thing on local sales taxes. Local sales taxes are actually dealt with initially in the property and local tax division, but they will all eventually end up here. There is some information about local sales taxes on starting on page 35 of the large document. When LGA was first passed in 1972, that LGA program included a prohibition against new local taxes on sales and income. Clearly, that there have been a lot of, notwithstanding that prohibition, special laws passed in this state. The first local sales tax was imposed in the 70s. Two of them were imposed in the 80s. There were three authorized. One just never was imposed. There were 18 authorized in the 90s. Eight of them were actually imposed. Two of them have since expired. After the 90s, it became pretty clear that these weren't going to go away, and there was a statutory provision put into the sales tax statute that basically laid out kind of some standard guidelines for imposing local sales taxes. They include voter approval, that the tax be for specific brick-and-mortar projects, and that the tax be sunset after 1 year. On page 35, you will see the start of a complete list of all the taxes currently imposed. There are 25 cities in the state with a tax of a half cent. That's generally the rate that's been allowed. Duluth and Cook County impose the tax at a rate of 1%. All of the local taxes that are imposed by special law, with the exception of Duluth, are supposed to expire. Five of them actually have. The city of Wilmer is the most recent. It's actually had their local sales tax expire twice. They've imposed it twice, and it expired twice, most recently December 31st, 2012. The tax ended in Wilmer. Having said that, the only one that doesn't expire is Duluth. Duluth is a very unique case. They were the first one. They actually were allowed to impose it under an open authority for 1 year. They are taxed at 1% instead of half cent. Their money goes into their general fund. They can spend it for whatever they want, and they have no expiration date. St. Paul actually is allowed to use a little bit of this money for operating. So they're a little bit like Duluth, that they at least have some flexibility to not have all of their money going to bricks and mortar. As I said, they all have expiration dates. Minneapolis's expiration date is when all bonds are paid off for the convention center. Well, Minneapolis gets around this by issuing new bonds for increased improvements to the convention center. So in theory, that one may never go off. The other one that's kind of interesting is the city of Rochester. Rochester has received 5 extensions to its initially enacted local sales tax, and it has never expired. It just comes back and gets authorization to use it for different projects. Having said that, with the exception of one of them, all of them have actually been passed by their voters. So although they've gotten extensions without it expiring, they have at least been ratified by their voters.
Ms. Dalton, can I ask you, other than the one Rochester non-voter approval, which of the pile that exists have not had to go to the people for a vote? Other than the Twins, I think we all remember that. But is it St. Paul and Duluth, or I'm trying to remember who never took an initial vote?
Madam Chair, I actually do have a list somewhere. There have been very few. There's been a couple that have had reverse referendums instead of a required referendum. Most of them have had it, you're right, the Hennepin County Ballpark did not. And the two that I'm going to talk about right now, which are the transportation and transit ones, I mean the transit one that's imposed in the metro area, also did not require going to the voters. It just required county board approval.
And can I ask you also, which cities have been granted the authority and not done it? I can think of one.
Bloomington was the one. Members of the committee, Bloomington was the one that was authorized in the 80s that did not do it.
And then the second time was just for the mall.
We actually
which
have,
they did not impose.
And I.
But are there other cities that have been given the authority and not used it?
There are, Madam Chair, members of the committee, there is about a dozen. Some of them chose not to go to the voters after being given the authority. Some of them actually failed the required referendum. There is actually an information brief on our Post Research website on local sales taxes that does have a table that has all of the ones that have been authorized, all the ones that are currently imposed, all the ones that have expired, all the ones that were authorized but didn't get imposed, and the 4 that are still out there that have authority that can still impose them but haven't imposed them yet.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Dalton, have any municipalities that have local sales taxes ever been required to share their sales tax revenue with other municipalities outside their borders? And if so, how often has that happened?
Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, a loaded question. As Representative Liebling knows, this last extension of Rochester's, which occurred in the 2011 legislative session, did require Rochester to share $5 million of their local sales tax revenue with a list of surrounding communities for individual projects through their EDAs or housing HRAs. And yes, Rochester is the only city that has been required to do that. The only other local sales tax where there is revenue sharing between cities is in the St. Cloud area, which is a consortium of 6 cities that all impose the sales tax. The majority of the money tends to go to these regional projects in St. Cloud, their airport and things like that, but a share of the money then goes back to the other cities that are part of that consortium, and then they use that for various other bricks and mortar projects within those communities.
So Representative Liebling, and then Representative Davids and Lesh, and I love that we have both Representative Davids and Representative Liebling on this committee, because I think the Rochester issues will be interesting this year. So Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And, of course, notably, I was off the committee for the last couple of years when all of this went down. But does Lanesboro also have a local sales tax, Ms. Dalton?
Madam
and are they required to share it?
Ms. Dalton. Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, Lanesboro also was one of the six cities that were received local sales tax authority in the 2011 session. No, they do not have to show.
Okay, Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And just for clarification for new members, that was known as the Greg Davids good neighbor policy, like a good neighbor. Greg Davids is there. And also, I would just point out that over 60% of those funds are confiscated from people outside the city limits of Rochester. So just a mere little good neighbor policy. You didn't notice all the letters to the editor bashing Rochester from local officials outside. And it was just the right thing to do, and I know that Rochester is very happy to have done it.
Representative Lely?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wonder, Ms. Dalton, the word confiscation with regard to sales taxes, are sales taxes considered confiscation? I mean, there is a where I'm going with this is you don't pay a tax unless you voluntarily go to a place and spend money there. Am I right about that? I mean, it's voluntary in the sense that if you don't pay the tax unless you're purchasing something. Am I right?
Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, you must be making a purchase in Rochester to be subject to the Rochester local sales.
And
Representative Liebling.
Madam Chair, and just to be clear, nobody outside Rochester is required to come to Rochester to make a purchase. Would that be fair to say?
Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, I'm going to defer to Representative Davids.
Yes, you know, and I hope new members now see what nonpartisan staff really means. So, Representative
Well,
Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the members of the committee. I should have stated previously that in a survey, 98.3% of my constituents called it confiscation. So I was referring to my survey, and technically Representative Liebling is right, but practically she's not.
Thank you. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to point out that while St. Paul, I don't think under statute, is required to share our tax revenue, we are more than happy to share all the services we provide with neighboring communities. For example, all the suburban married dads that come in and get busted for prostitution in St. Paul, the police take care of that free of charge.
Anyone? Representative Marquardt.
Madam Chair, we could have solved all of this debate on local option sales tax if the bill that came through your committee a few years ago said that cities and counties couldn't even dream about a local option sales tax. That was a violation of law. If you look at a chart there, there's a couple years where there's no new extensions because that was by law you could not. So we could solve all of this by just reinstating that law.
Yes, Representative Marquardt, I do think that's something this committee has to grapple with once again because that moratorium worked, and once it went away, here they come again. Representative Carlson.
A different tax with the same debate, fiscal disparities.
Yes. Yes.
Tax sharing.
We have a lot of tax sharing locally, much more than the sales tax, so yes. Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, I'm trying to move on. There are two statutory authorities for local general purpose local sales taxes in Chapter 297A. One is for the Metropolitan Transit Tax of 0.25%. That is currently imposed by county board approval in 5 counties out of the 7 counties. The two remaining metro counties have the option of imposing that tax in the future, or if they don't want to become part of that, they also have the option of imposing up to a half-cent sales tax. The other statutorily allowed tax is a half-cent sales tax for transportation purposes in any county outside of the transit tax area. So it's the other 80 counties plus the two that have not imposed the transit tax. They can impose up to a half-cent for a specific transportation purpose, provided they get voter approval in the county. Nobody has used that authority at this point. The tax under that authority would have to expire whenever the specific transportation project was done. The Metro Transit tax does not expire. There are a few special taxes that also exists in law. There is a statutory authority for a local lodging tax of up to 3% any place in the state, and that if a city or town or county wants to impose it, it has 95% of the revenues have to be used for tourism purposes. There's about 100 local governments that currently impose that tax, and it tends to be collected locally. Then there is about 15 special law lodging, food and beverage, and admissions taxes throughout the state. They tend to be often for operating costs of facilities. Mankato has a food and beverage tax for operation of a an arena that they actually funded using their general sales tax. And so those other special taxes, there's some up in Bowabic to help fund Giants Ridge, and those special taxes tend not to expire. And
Ms. Dalton, is there any member of this committee that you can think of that doesn't represent a city that has some of these local taxes of one form or another? I mean, does anybody here know? Would anybody be willing to strike out that you have, your district doesn't have one? Because I think everybody's got one. Representative Draskowski, you don't think you have a liquor or a lodging or admissions or... How about an aggregate tax? Is that in the list? Nope. Maybe. Anybody else? I mean, I think most of us deal with these local issues. Representative Rumbeck? You think there's any up there? And is it White Bear Lake and Shoreview, or what's your line of lakes? Yeah, I guess the Seven County Metro, a lot of us have the transit tax, but
yeah.
Anybody else think they don't have any? Representative Malik, well, you've got, wow. But I think you're right on this menu. You maybe don't have any. We're all amazed at what your predecessors brought to the Minnesota legislature and trying to understand the taconite tax and all the revenue streams and where they go. But is the Cook, so you don't have any at Cook or St. Louis County? Don't they have a the 1% tax?
Talking about
you don't have Cook. Okay. No, we're just talking about all these local taxes that Representative Ms. Dalton went through. I just highlight it because often members forget that we're all kind of dealing with our own little bucket of local issues. And we're also supposed to try to do good state policy, so we're all in this. Representative Ansels, do you have any?
None.
Okay, thank you. Just wondering. Does Edina have any of this? Oh, they have lodging, don't they?
No. Fiscal disturbance is a tax on us.
Yes, but that's another day. Thank you, Ms. Dalton. There's a lot there. Yeah. There's not many that don't have twins. Hennepin has the twins. That's right. Everybody in Hennepin. Yeah. Yep. Hennepin. Yeah, the twins. Right. Do you have a lodging tax, maybe?
Mm-hmm. If you're going to do it, let them own it. Yeah. As long as they share with their neighbors.
Well, and as they're getting ready, I just think it's an interesting discussion. Representative Lesh, what you raised, I and Representative Slocum and others who represent the 494 corridor between the airport, you know, we deal with those same issues of prostitution as well. The hospitality industry has lots of visitors. So, you know, I hear what you're saying, but it also, we're funding it too, and the bomb squad and everything else, and so we all have a different bucket of issues we bring to this group. So who's up? Is it Ms. Templin?
Yes, Madam Chair. I just want to make sure we're on the right slide because the versions of the slides that you have yesterday are slightly different. We are on slide 59. Does your slides show the tax incidence charts?
Yep.
Yep. Okay. Okay. Yes. Good. Okay, so just checking in then. Moving on to the corporate taxes, again, just to carry on the theme of tax incidence and looking at tax incidence for each of the tax types. Again, we're looking at, for corporate taxes, this slide shows, again, the effective tax rate, which is the ratio of taxes paid to household income. And again, this is data taken from the tax incidence report for 2011.
Similar to sales tax, this slide shows that the corporate tax is a regressive tax because the first quintile pays the largest share relative to household income. And you can see as income rises, the effective tax rate is reduced. Okay, and then moving to the next slide, it shows the percentage of corporate taxes paid by quintile. And again, similar to the sales tax, the first quintile, being the group with the lowest incomes, is paying the smallest share of the total corporate taxes. And moving up to the fifth quintile, they are paying 44% of the total corporate taxes paid. Just as a point of reference, the fifth quintile pays $226 million in corporate taxes. And that is it for the tax incidence slides.
Members of the committee, Joel Michael from House Research. I'll go through the description of the corporate franchise tax. This tax is often referred to as the corporate income tax. At the federal level, it's called the corporate income tax. States call them franchise taxes if they want to be able to tax the income from U.S. government obligations that are received by corporations. You got a state has to call it a franchise tax because that's an artifact of federal law. So Minnesota calls its tax a corporate franchise tax. The tax base is the profits of C corporations, and the C refers to the subchapter of the Internal Revenue Code that defines the types of corporations that are subject to this. And that's a very small subset of corporations. That's changed significantly since the middle 80s. In the middle 80s, about close to 80% of corporations were C corporations because at that time the tax rules were favorable to C corporations. The tax rates that applied to C corporations were lower than the individual tax rates, and it was easy for the owners of C corporations to get profits out of them if they were closely held without paying individual tax on those profits when they were taken out of the C corporation. The Tax Reform Act of 86 totally changed that landscape and reversed the situation where then corporations were subject to higher rates than individuals, and because for those of you who took tax years ago like me in law school, Congress repealed the general utilities doctrine, which made it very difficult to get profits out of C corps without paying individual level tax. That caused this situation to reverse. Now, I look back in the early 80s, like I said, about 70% of corporations were C corporations. Now, it's about 22%. And so the balance are S corporations, and when you think about it, most of these closely held businesses are actually not corporations at all, but they're LLCs or their partnerships. So in the business world, there are very, very few businesses other than publicly held companies. So largely what we're talking about here are the companies who are traded on the stock exchange. Most small businesses, medium-sized businesses, and large businesses that are closely held don't pay tax under this regime. So that's really important to keep that in mind. That's why I spent a fair amount of time on it. And again, the tax base is profits. So if a corporation is not making profit, it doesn't owe the tax. Second, the third really important concept in thinking about the corporate franchise tax, because this is a state tax and many of these businesses operate in many states, constitutionally, a state can only tax the income that's fairly apportioned to its own state. And so the way that's done in the state corporate taxes is you use an apportionment formula and you say what share of your, in the classic cases, what share of your property, payroll, and sales are attributable to the state, and that fraction was used to multiply times your income, your profits, to determine the in-state taxable income. Traditionally, that was a three-factor equally weighted formula, as we'll talk about a little bit later. Most states are going to heavily weight sales. Minnesota now is 1 year away from 100%. Sales were at 96.2. So sales count 96.6%, and property 2, and payroll 2. The tax rate is 9.8%. So those are the basics about the tax. There are also, Minnesota has a variety of credits that are allowed, just like on the individual tax. There's an R&D credit. There's a credit for taxes paid to other states. This is really unimportant because the basic regime is that we figure out how much of your income is Minnesota income, and that's what you pay tax on, and we don't care what you pay in other states. There's jobs either exemptions and credits for that, and there's the historic structure credit, which Ms. Manzi talked about in the individual level before. There's also a minimum fee under the corporate franchise tax, and the key thing about this minimum fee is it's not limited to C corporations, but it applies to all business organization types that have sufficient activity in Minnesota. Basically, if your sales, property, and payroll are less than $500,000, you don't owe this tax, and the maximum amount of it is $5,000 for the very biggest corporations. Revenues from the tax for fiscal 13 are estimated to be $1.1 billion. Thing to note about the revenues from the corporate tax are they're the most volatile of all of our revenue sources. On the slide, I showed just how volatile they can be. In fiscal 2002, we collected just over $500,000 from the tax. That's a little bit understated. That was, of course, during a recession, but that was also before we had tightened up the foreign operating corporation rules, so that drug down those collections a little bit too. Then at the height of the expansion in the last decade, we collected almost $1.2 billion, or twice as much as in the trough. Then in 2010, just 3 years later, we're back down to just $660 million. So it's a roller. These revenues have the state on a roller coaster ride. Fortunately, they're a small share of our tax revenues, only about 5%.
Mr. Michael, Representative Davids.
Yes, as to the committee, regarding Representative Liebling's in my previous conversation regarding confiscation, I mentioned 98.3. I think it was 98.3, but I've since destroyed the survey results. That's from several years ago, so I just want to clear that up. It's approximately that. But what I would like to ask Mr. Michael, if I could you explain to the committee the Gillette case as it relates to the state of Minnesota?
Yes, Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Davids, and members of the committee, the Gillette case is a case that is a court of appeals case in California that was decided, and it relates to the apportionment factors and membership in what's called the Multi-State Tax Commission. Under the Multi-State Tax Commission compact. This is an interstate compact among states that are members of that of the commission. Essentially, what the compact says is that taxpayers in paying tax or owing tax in member states have the option of calculating their tax either under the state's normal rules or under what's called the Uniform Division of Income for Tax Purposes Act, which is a uniform act that was promulgated by the Uniform Law Commissioners. And that UDITPA, which is the acronym that people, that tax practitioners refer to it by, that act allows the use of arithmetic apportionment. And so, for example, when Minnesota became a member of the compact, which was back in 1983, if I recall correctly, Minnesota at that time had optional weighted apportionment. We allowed corporations to choose, do you want to use arithmetic apportionment or do you want to use weighted apportionment where your sales count 70%? Minnesota had that regime from 1939 through 1987. And so adopting the compact, it made no difference. And most states like California, when it adopted the compact, just used arithmetic apportionment. What's happened was that Minnesota, for example, in 1987, said we're not going to allow arithmetic apportionment as an option anymore. Instead, we're going to require corporations to use weighted apportionment, use the 70% sales. Now we're at 96, and next year we'll be at 100%. That has differential effects on multi-state corporations depending upon where they have most of their operations. If you have most of your operations outside Minnesota, for example, you may just have a regional sales office and service facilities here, but you sell a lot of things to Minnesotans, Minnesota buyers, then your sales factor will be much higher than your property and payroll factor. In that case, you would prefer using arithmetic apportionment. By contrast, if you're one of our big headquartered companies and have very much of your property and payroll here, take, for example, some of our well-known corporations like General Mills or 3M. They have a very high percentage of their property and payroll here. But Minnesotans don't buy more Cheerios on average than their share of the country. And so their sales are probably, you know, 2 or 3%, whereas their property and payroll are much higher. For them, it's advantageous to use sales apportionment because then it says only 2% of your income is attributable to Minnesota. So when Minnesota went to requiring weighted sales in 1987, it said you're not going to be able to use the UDITPA option under the MTC option, and you're not going to also be able to use our old option, which was for arithmetic apportionment. California is a more recent state that's gone to weighted apportionment. They originally went to double weighted sales, and then later on by voter action we went to 100% sales. What Gillette did, obviously Gillette's a big consumer goods company, makes a lot of razors and other stuff that they sell. They don't manufacture many of them in California. They said, wait a minute, we've got the option in California to figure our apportionment out based on that old option. It doesn't matter that the California legislature repealed the arithmetic option under the compact, because they argued when we entered the compact, when we, California, entered it in that case, they made a contract that they can't break by just changing their law. Instead, they have to pull out of the compact. And the California Court of Appeals agreed with Gillette in that case and said, yes, Gillette, you do have the authority under compact principles to elect arithmetic apportionment. California is appealing that to the California Supreme Court, obviously, because that will cost them a bunch of revenue. That same principle could be extended to Minnesota, so this is a concern in Minnesota. IBM sued Michigan on the same basis because Michigan's 100% sales state. The Michigan court did not agree. The Michigan Court of Appeals did not agree with IBM held to the state. That's on appeal to the Michigan Supreme Court. So this is an issue that will be up before the legislature, and it's a good way to illustrate the effect of these apportionment regimes, which are really one of the very most important parts of the corporate franchise tax. And I'll skip over this next slide, which is the phase-in of single sales. That's pretty clear. As we indicated, the chair has asked us to talk about possible ways to reform the corporate tax, or all of the taxes. Corporate tax is a very difficult one to talk about in this regard, because if you talk to experts, I think most of the experts will say you shouldn't have a corporate tax, because it's not a good tax, because it fails on a variety of different... I mean, one of the things that's often said about it is it's a state corporate taxes are taxes, corporate profits taxes are taxes that are in search of a theory to justify them. and the problem is illustrated, goes back to the base argument. So many types of businesses are not subject to this tax that it's sort of become problematic. It's largely just publicly held companies, so it's become a tax on, if you want to access national capital markets by having your stock trade on a stock exchange, we're going to impose this special tax on you. As a matter of economic theory, that's a very inefficient thing to do because it's a restriction on access to capital. And it favors smaller and closely held businesses. I know the discussion around here has been, let's start exempting profits of closely held businesses like partnerships and S-corps and so forth. But the reality is that these C-corps are paying tax at the entity level once, and then when they distribute the profits to their shareholders, either as dividends or as their realized capital gains, they're paying tax again. And so there's a double tax that's sort of involved by comparison to the S-corp or the partnership that's really not paying a business tax at all. They're just paying the individual income tax. So that's the general context in which it's kind of difficult to know how you reform this tax other than to reduce it. I mean, the big problem with it, as I indicated, the revenues are very, very volatile in that they, when you go through the business cycle, they go up with expansions and way down with contractions, and it makes budgeting, you know, very difficult. So, but anyway, the normal rubric with reform is expand the base and reduce the rate because that makes the tax more neutral and fairer. And so the way, you know, some of the ways I've listed here to do that would be to cut back the foreign income preferences that we have, for example. Those, again, on a theory basis are somewhat difficult to justify. You know, and much of the justifications for these things come from the business community saying, gee, you need to do this to make us competitive. It's hard when you think through the economic theory of some of that, mm-hmm. how that exactly works out, other than them saying we would like more money because that helps our businesses to have more money. You could repeal some of the credits, for example. You could cut back the R&D credit, although there's, you know, a general justification for that. Or you could go back on single sales apportionment, go back to arithmetic apportionment. As a matter of theory, the tax ought to sort of relate to how much activity you have in Minnesota, not how much you sell in Minnesota. That's makes it like a sales or a consumption tax. But on the other hand, we don't want to do that because then it penalizes putting property and payroll in Minnesota. We want to make our businesses competitive. And once you get to single sales, businesses, you can say to business, it doesn't matter whether you put another factory in Minnesota. It's not going to change your tax. Your tax will be exclusively be determined by how much you sell in the Minnesota market. And virtually no business is going to say, oh, we don't want to sell in Minnesota because, you know, we're going to pay a little bit of tax on the profits we earn from that. So you're generally, even though if you talk to tax theorists, they would say it's not wise to have a single sales apportionment, competitiveness arguments say, yes, do that because that's the way we make it more attractive for businesses to put their capital in Minnesota. So that's my discussion of reform options of the corporate tax, which is mixed at best, although I think most people would say we could make it better by just reducing reliance on it and reducing the rate. But it's very difficult because, as all of you know, as people who run for office, a tax that nobody understands who pays, which is exactly what we're talking about here, is a nice tax to have because it's opaque. Nobody knows about it, and it provides revenue to run government. That's the reality.
Excuse me, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Michael, just back to the Gillette case a little bit. Is Minnesota at risk? Are we sitting out there? I mean, could Amway come forward and instead of Gillette, it's Amway or whoever? Let's say it's Gillette. They come to Minnesota and try to do the same thing. Are we sitting out there at risk where we could be owing some money or not collecting as much?
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Davis. Yes, we're in structurally, we're in the same situation that California is. It's a little bit of a difference when we adopted it, and the way the way we wrote our law is a little bit different than California, but if it becomes a compact constitutional issue, we are at risk. And if the California Court of Appeals decision is correct, probably the only way to avoid it for future years is for the state to withdraw from the compact, or for the compact terms to be changed. And yes, Procter & Gamble, which is the company that owns Gillette, would be, they're in the same practical situation in Minnesota. Again, Tide and all of their products and Gillette razors and all of the stuff that they make, they don't make that stuff in Minnesota, to my knowledge. But I'm willing to bet that Minnesotans buy the same share of Tide as people from Ohio, which is their home state, do.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr.
Thank
Michael.
You. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Michael, the previous slide had something about alternative minimum tax, and could you just talk briefly about that? Is that the tax that a company pays even if they have not had anything in sales? I mean, that they've really actually had losses and they have to pay this tax?
Madam Chair, Representative Runbeck, Minnesota has two minimum taxes. One, we have a minimum tax, an AMT that's based on the federal alternative minimum tax, and that also is a profits-based tax. And so it just has a broader measure of net income. It has slower depreciation rules. It does not recognize some of the preferences that are there for, like, oil companies and that sort of thing. That tax, is just a broader-based profits tax with a lower rate. There's also this minimum fee that really is, that applies to all types of entities. It's not an alternative, though. That's an add-on tax, and it is unrelated to your profitability. What I was suggesting here, one reform option, Minnesota, for a very short period of time, our business community absolutely hated it, had what was called a factors alternative minimum tax. And that said, just based on how much activity you have in Minnesota, you will owe tax liability unless your regular corporate profits tax is higher. Obviously, if you think about that, what that does is it makes the tax revenues much more stable, because it no longer depends upon these big cycles in the profits of the publicly held companies. But like I said, the business community, when that was enacted in 87, they immediately, went to work in the legislature saying this is a really bad thing, because many businesses that don't have profits are paying tax. Help us figure out a way that we can repeal that, and the legislature repealed it in a matter of 2 years. Now, the tax theorist would say, hey, it shouldn't depend upon whether the business has profits, whether it pays tax or not, because the theory for taxing a business is not that you're taxing their profits, because they're not like individuals. They have no ability to pay. They're just firms or entities that are helping people engage in transactions. And so tax theory says you should tax a business organization roughly equal to what it uses in government services. Then those government services will be reflected in the business's prices that they charge, and you'll have an efficient market. And so it really shouldn't matter whether the business has actually got profits or not. And that's really what it makes the tax much more acceptable, because the response of the business community to the factors tax was, gee, we're not profitable. This is the worst time in the world for us to be paying revenue over to the government. But of course, the economist would say, yeah, but you're still using government services, so you can't stop paying your other suppliers just because you're not making money. That doesn't sell too well out in the real world.
Mr. Michael, and I think about this one a lot too, and similarly, individuals don't get to not pay their property tax because they're unemployed. We don't say you lost your job, you don't have to pay your property taxes. You have to anyhow, because you're using local services, whether it's snow plowing or whatever. So we don't give people a pass because they're not making a profit.
Madam Chair and Mr. Michael, the minimum fee then, which I, here's another one, Is that not current? I mean, is that currently being levied, and what does the state collect from that?
Maybe Ms. Templin has it.
Madam Chair, Representative Runbeck, that does currently apply. If you look on the Word document, there is, let me find the page that has the schedule. It ranges from $100 to $5,000, depending upon, it's on page 44. Whoops, no, it's not on page 44. Somewhere it is. Thanks. 39, okay.
Yeah.
And I do not know, it's been a while since I've asked revenue exactly how much revenue is collected from. I don't know.
Madam Chair, Representative Runbeck, it's in the neighborhood of $35 million annually is collected from the fee.
All right. Great. Thank you.
Other questions?
We're going to move on from this, the most difficult and confusing of the taxes, to the more simpler ones, the smaller taxes, and we'll try to finish in a few minutes. We're going to do the excise taxes now.
Madam Chair, just quickly, again, the excise taxes include, for this presentation, the fuels, taxes, cigarettes, liquor, and the health impact fee. Again, you probably know after going through this several times now, the effective tax rate is the ratio of the taxes paid to household income. This slide is similar to sales tax and corporate tax in that it shows regressivity, where the first quintile is paying a larger share compared to their total income. Again, the next slide is the percent of tax paid, and by quintile. And again, this shows a range of 14.4% of total taxes paid in the first quintile compared to the fifth quintile at almost 30% of total taxes paid.
The first one of these that we'll go over is the motor fuels tax. This is oftentimes referred to as the gas tax. Under the Constitution, this is required to be put into the Highway User Trust Fund. There are two tax rates. There's the basic 25-cent per gallon rate, and then there's an additional debt service surcharge of 3.5 cents per gallon. So the combined rate under the tax is 28 cents. Local governments do receive a share of this under the CASA and the formula and the municipal state aid street formula. In fiscal 13, it's projected to raise $880 million. And Mr. Biggerstaff, who's going to be doing the tobacco and alcohol taxes and the mortgage registry taxes, is going to come up and do that. So he and I are going to be switching back and forth here.
Mr. Biggerstaff.
Madam Chair, members, one of the other taxes I'll be covering is the cigarette and tobacco tax. As you can see, the tax on cigarettes is a per unit tax, so it's a tax on each cigarette. The effective rate is 48 cents per pack of 20. There's also a tax on other tobacco products, which includes a whole host of definitions contained in the statute. The tax of that is 35% of the wholesale price of those other tobacco products. There's also an additional health impact fee, which applies to the sale of tobacco products, which is 75 cents per pack of cigarettes and an additional 35% of the wholesale costs for other tobacco products. And that fee is statutorily mandated to go into a health impact fund.
Grab some gravel.
Madam Chair, just an observation, and I know times are tough in the House of Representatives, but can we get Mr. Riggerstaff?
A name tag that doesn't have labels.
I think somewhere in your committee budget we can probably arrange for the dollars to get you an official House of Representatives name tag. Can you commit to the minority party here that you're going to make that happen, Madam Chair?
I think so, Representative Garofalo. You know, it's funny you say that because speaking about times being tough in the Minnesota House, today I was getting water out of the coolers that are in the floor on the floors. And can everyone recall when Representative Swigum said, times are tough, and he got rid of the water? Remember that? And I was thinking, maybe we need to get rid of the water.
Well,
do you remember Representative Speaker Swigum had no water, and he limited the paper. He did a whole bunch of things to try to reduce the House budget.
Madam Chair, you'll notice he's not Speaker anymore.
Representative Garofalo?
Well, Madam Chair, with the Democrats in charge, I expect by the end of the year we're going to have EVN bottled water and tofu and all the break rooms.
No. Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, getting rid of the water was one thing, but as I recall, he also got rid of the clock.
That's right, Far Representative Dabney. In the retiring room, there was no coffee. Representative Earhart, you were part of that caucus. What was Representative Swiggum thinking? Tell us about that. What was that, a caucus?
It wasn't any of that. It was the toilet paper when you got rid of that.
Undermining the forest products.
I do think, Representative Garofalo, we're going to have to get that name tag taken care of, or we're going to keep thinking about what Representative Earhart said all year. Mr. Biggerstaff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, as you can see, the revenue raised from the cigarette and tobacco tax in fiscal year 2013 is projected at $421 million. That does include the health impact fee, which is roughly $31 million. And again, that's statutorily dedicated to the health impact fund. There's also an additional 35-cent per pack fee, which applies to non-settlement cigarettes. And that's included in that figure at about $2.7 million. The alcohol beverage excise tax, this is a tax on alcoholic beverages that is applied on a per unit basis. It's calculated by gallons or liters. And you can see the relative rates for different types of alcohol there. Generally, the rate is applied without regard to alcohol content, with the exception of wine. There are certain categories for, I think it's 14% to 21% and 21 to 25% alcohol. There's different effective rates for different wines with varying alcohol content. And the effective tax revenue is projected at $79 million in this tax. And then there's also an alcoholic beverage gross receipts tax. Going back briefly to the streamlined sales and use tax, there used to be a different sales tax rate applied to alcoholic beverages, but to become compliant with the streamline agreement, Minnesota had to do away with the higher sales tax on alcohol, so a gross receipts tax was implemented. And in 2010, this raised about $67.6 million.
You know, excuse me, this is a mystery to me. Everybody's turned off their phone, right? This is still happening. I don't know if maybe the next time we meet, Kyle and Kelly can talk to folks who do this for us, and maybe they can come down and give us a tutorial why this keeps happening. I've never heard it that bad this year. It continues. Ms. Dalton says on silent does not work. The power must be powered off.
Or you can turn it to airplane.
Does that work?
Yeah,
it shuts off. And you know why I'm sticking on it is because what folks may not know is people at home cannot hear what's going on. If you try to watch it on your TV with that happening, and I've done that where I've tried to watch like a Senate tax hearing when we've gotten home early on a Friday, say, you cannot hear it. It's just going through the feed, and it's much more annoying to Minnesotans than it is to us. So we're going to have to really master that because I think we're all being distracted instead of listening to you, and so that means it's much worse for the tape. So,
all right, we've got about three more taxes to go through, and I'm going to just, these are the insurance premiums and mortgage registry and deed taxes. You can see, again, the graph patterns where these are regressive taxes with the bottom quintile paying a much higher percent, but, of course, more revenue comes from the top quintile. Motor vehicle license tax, this is often referred to as the TAB tax. It's really a property tax that's based on the value of your car or a light pickup truck. Sort of thing. It's basically the tax rates, 1.25% of the base value. There's a depreciation schedule in the statute. Tax never gets lower than $35, and it hits that when it's 11 years old. The money in this, by the Constitution, has to go to the highways under the Highway User Trust Fund. Some of it goes to the local governments, again, $545 million for fiscal 11. Minnesota care taxes, tax base for these is gross revenues of health care providers, tax rates 2%. revenues go to fund the Minnesota Care Program and the Health Care Access Fund. This tax, by action of the 2011 legislature, is set to sunset in 2020. Revenues for 13 are projected to be just over $500 million. The insurance premiums tax is basically a sales tax on purchasing insurance at a tax rate of 2%. There are lower rates that apply to some mutual companies. Township mutuals are exempt, and there are lower rates on what used to be domestic mutuals, but now, because we had to be neutral with regard to states, it's sort of based on how many assets you had back in the 1980s at some point.
Mr. Michael, excuse me, Ms. Representative Moline has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Michael, just to these taxes, specifically the Minnesota care tax that is, I guess, dedicated revenue, has that been used for purposes other than what it was supposed to be dedicated for?
Madam Chair, Representative Moline, I'm probably not the best one to answer that, because most of those decisions get made in the Health and Human Services Committee when they. I think it is accurate to say that there have been a couple of years when there may have been money, but I don't quote me on that. I'm not. I can. We'll go back and find out from the fiscal staff whether
okay.
there were times when money from that fund. Oh.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kathy Schillhouse, fiscal. I used to work on the Health and Human Services Committee before I came to the Tax Committee. I would say from this 2%, it has not been used for other purposes, but if you do look at a summary of the Health Care Access Fund, yes, there have been transfers from that fund, but there are a host of other sources of revenue that contribute into that fund. We can get you the most recent Health Care Access Fund table if you'd like to look at that.
That would be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, another main source of that fund is the premiums that people pay on the insurance. So the insurance premium tax, again, is like a sales tax on insurance. There's a lower rate on life insurance at 1.5%. A 1% rate applies to HMOs and nonprofits, and that tax goes into the Health Care Access Fund, the tax that applies to HMOs and nonprofits. The rest of the insurance premium tax goes into the general fund, but the portion of it that's paid on fire insurance largely goes to pay fire pensions, and on auto insurance goes to pay police pensions through those pension aids that the property tax division, property and local tax division applies to. One of the interesting things about the insurance premium tax is that, unlike other taxes, Congress has exempted this from the rules that apply restricting states' ability to essentially affect interstate commerce, so we can't actually discriminate against other states. And so there's a retaliatory tax that applies. That retaliatory tax says, expressing this in shorthand, for a company that's domiciled in another state, which in the insurance world they call those foreign companies, even though they're U.S.
Iowa.
Companies, but they're foreign to Minnesota, if that foreign company's state of domicile taxes Minnesota companies at a higher rate than we do, we will tax their companies at their rate. And so, for example, if you have a Alabama company that has a 4% tax in Alabama, when it does business in Minnesota, we tax it at 4%, even though the other companies are paying at 2%. And that's only because Congress lets us do that.
And Mr. Michael, I wish we could get to the estate tax, but we're not going to, because we're going to have to turn. I do want to make a quick announcement. We are not going to meet on Tuesday, and we'll send out an email because the governor's budget will come out that day, and I don't think people will be thinking to come to tax committee, because everybody will be trying to figure what's in the governor's budget. So let's just not meet Tuesday, so people just don't have to think about that, and we'll just pick this up on Wednesday. So with that, we're adjourned.